WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, opting out of pot. Marijuana is legal for personal use in New York State for adults 21 and over and could be for sale at dispensaries soon, but some local towns might can cannabis businesses. Our own Patricio Rubio is here to tell us more. Leif Johansson takes a deep dive into how those local governments are structured. It's a bizarre world of administrative divisions, and we get an excerpt from his Radio Catskill podcast, Close to Home, and the amazing world of honeybees, why they're important, and why New York City has an actual bee cop, plus a preview of tomorrow's Riverfest. Kevin McDonough is here to talk about the river dogs on parade. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Today is the first day that medals are being awarded at the Summer Olympics in Tokyo, but the U.S. has come away empty-handed so far after several upsets. NPR's Tom Goldman is in Tokyo.
Today was the first time since 1972 the USA did not win a medal on the first day medals were awarded. It'll happen. Many soccer fans hoping the U.S. women's national team will grab one. They had a bad start with a loss to Sweden, and they're trying to right the ship tonight against New Zealand.
China won the game's first gold medal in the women's 10-meter rifle competition. Medals also handed out today in archery, cycling, fencing, judo, and weightlifting. A state of emergency has been declared in a rural Nevada county due to a wildfire that's burned close to 60,000 acres in Nevada and California. Lucia Starbuck with member station KUNR in Reno reports.
The Tamarack Fire started as a lightning strike to a tree in a remote area in California early this month. And earlier this week, the fire crossed state lines into Nevada. It destroyed multiple structures, is threatening more than 2,700 homes, and forcing at least 3,500 people to evacuate in one county. Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak declared the state of emergency to ensure Douglas County receives the assistance that's needed. In the declaration, Sisolak says the county is facing a resource shortage and needs help protecting people, property, and the county's watersheds that could be impacted by post-fire erosion. For NPR News, I'm Lucia Starbuck in Reno.
That fire in Nevada is just one of dozens burning in western states amid drought that's becoming more regular from climate change. In the U.S., COVID cases are rising nearly everywhere, driven by the twice-as-contagious Delta strain. NPR's Amy Held reports that some places are reimposing restrictions, including mask mandates, to beat back the surge.
More than a third of counties across the U.S. are experiencing high levels of community transmission, according to the CDC. In Louisiana, cases have jumped more than 200% in recent weeks. Dr. Vincent Shaw, a family and sports medicine physician in Baton Rouge, says vaccine hesitancy is a problem.
Sort of sets the clock back to where we were, you know, a year ago.
With fewer than 40% of residents vaccinated, Louisiana's governor is recommending masking up indoors. In Los Angeles County, it's again mandated. Same in St. Louis, Missouri, starting Monday. Meantime, the national surge is forecast to only accelerate. A group of researchers working with the CDC expects it will peak in October. Amy Held, NPR News.
Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt says he will file a lawsuit to stop that new mask mandate from going into effect in St. Louis and St. Louis County. This is NPR News. Rescue teams in western India searching for survivors following flooding and landslides sparked by torrential monsoon rain. More than 100 people are reported dead in Maharashtra state. Experts say the region is being hit by the heaviest July rains in years. Australia reported 176 new locally acquired COVID cases today, a third consecutive daily record, with nearly all cases in the state of New South Wales. There were protests against a month-long coronavirus lockdown in three cities. The BBC's Phil Mercer reports on demonstrators who clashed with police in Australia's largest city of Sydney.
We want freedom! We want freedom!
Freedom was the cry as thousands of anti-lockdown demonstrators marched through Sydney. Some brought their children and few were wearing masks. There were scuffles with the police and roads were blocked. Health officials said large protests in three Australian cities would put lives at risk. The police said the consequences could be disastrous. Sydney has been in lockdown for a month, yet its COVID-19 outbreak appears to be getting much worse.
The BBC's Phil Mercer reporting. President Biden is spending the weekend in Delaware after campaigning last night for Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate for Virginia governor. Biden made a short trip across the Potomac River to Arlington, Virginia, to speak at a rally for McAuliffe. That off-year election is being watched closely as a national bellwether. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, thanking the people who make public radio great every day and also those who listen. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York recently became the 15th state to legalize marijuana for recreational use. Cannabis has been legal for medical use for many years in New York, but no medical dispensaries exist in Sullivan County. As of April, marijuana is legal for personal recreational use for adults over 21 anywhere tobacco use is allowed. Soon, the sale of marijuana will be permitted, and currently the state is putting together regulations for commercial sale. However, not all towns in Sullivan County will be participating. They have to decide by December 31st. Our own Patricio Rubio has the first of a multi-part series on New York's decision to legalize adult recreational marijuana use. It's in the Sullivan County Democrat, and Patricio joins us now. Patricio, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, fantastic. And it's a beautiful day today. So.
Happy Saturday. Now, where is the state with these commercial regulations? They're putting them together, you report in your Democrat article.
Well, as of right now, they're still in talks as far as the language of actually the licenses. And what I understand is going to be a certain amount of licenses available, much like how it was for medical marijuana when medical marijuana first came on board for New York State. There was a limited number of medical licenses that companies could apply for and to be able to sell medical marijuana. And as of right now, all those licenses are taken up. So from what I understand is the same similar thing is going to happen to the recreational marijuana, where companies or stores who want to sell it would have to apply for a license, just like you would do for alcohol license or cigarettes.
Right. And so then once those regulations are put together, concurrently, I guess, towns have until December 31st to decide whether they're going to opt out of allowing businesses to sell commercially?
Right. As of right now, towns, villages, cities throughout New York have up to December 31st to decide whether to opt out. Opting out of having a store or business in their town that sells marijuana, and also having a store or business that has on-site consumption, just like you have a distillery or a wine tasting room. The law allows for on-site consumption. But the towns have the option to opt out of that. But they do have the option, if they do opt out of it and later on want to opt back in, they could. But from what I understand, they can't do the reverse, meaning if they have a business that shows up in their town or that goes through the planning board system and gets approved and opens up, and now the town says, hey, I don't want that kind of business in my town, they can't reverse it, from what I understand.
And in your reporting, you surveyed town supervisors throughout the county. Again, this is a business. It would apply to whatever code that the town has, according to their town codes. But some of them are saying that they may not want it. What is the overall thing that you sort of discovered? And then we'll go deeper into some of the towns that you talked to.
Sure, definitely. Overall, it seems like mostly – now, I just want to make a note. I did interview the town supervisors. Now, a lot of them so these are the ideas and the thoughts of the town supervisors, not at the full board. Of course, the full board has to approve it before the town can opt out, and it might be some people who are for it, might be some people who are against it. But for the general census, not everyone's against it, against the sale or the use of it. But some of them are not comfortable having them in their small quote, bedroom type towns, small communities, and to have a on-site consumption or to have a dispensary in their town, they might not feel comfortable with it. They may think it might be better for bigger towns than a smaller town, let's say Forestburg.
So even though this could potentially be a revenue driver for the town, some towns are saying maybe not in our neighborhood.
Maybe not. And from what I gather,
in theory, as you say.
Yeah, in theory, right. And what I gather, it's mostly because of, I guess, they're not aware or not sure how they can enforce it. And they're worried about impaired driving, which is, you know, it's a real concern, of course. It's a real concern with alcohol driving also. But they're concerned about, you know, impaired driving if these type of businesses do show up in their town.
And again, you spoke to several town supervisors, and as you note in your article in Sullivan County Democrat, these views are expressed of the town supervisor and not reflective of the whole town board, and these town supervisors are indicating how they might vote if a resolution about this was in front of them. So let's talk about some of the town supervisors in Bethel. What did town of Bethel Supervisor Dan Sturm have to say about it?
He feels he's for it. He feels that the planning board would approve it. So he said this type of business does meet their code, and they welcome it. I have a quote here. In the past, they were very supportive of the local farmer who applied for it to be one of the growers in marijuana. So that's the other side of this. It's not only, you know, what the towns are voting on now are voting to opt out of it, but what they can't change is sort of is the growery. So there's a whole other side of this that the farmers could benefit as being a grower of marijuana in the county.
Yeah, well, and I guess the town of Bethel is the home of Woodstock, so it would make sense if they were for it. What about the town of Calicoon? What were the impressions there?
Well, the town of Calicoon, they met with the undersheriff, and the sheriff came to one of the town board meetings and expressed their feelings. I haven't spoke to them directly, so this is going to secondhand. I do plan to speak to them. But they're I guess, also with the impaired driving, and they feel that, you know, we have the sites that are available, and people are going to them and may get into the car and drive home impaired, which is, you know, it happens, again, with alcohol consumption sites also. But the problem is what they're finding is they can't enforce it, or they can't have someone. How do you test someone who's under the influence of marijuana? When compared to alcohol, you could test someone with like a breathalyzer or something like that. For marijuana, right now, there's no direct test that could say, hey, this person is under the influence right now. Because you could have a joint, let's say, last week. It'll be in your system. It could show up in your system if you do some kind of blood work or urine test. But what the new law says in New York State, they're allowing the exploration of technologies that will be able to test the saliva to see if someone is under the influence while they're driving. And that could potentially allow officers to, you know, to enforce it, much like they do alcohol.
And in the town of Forestburg, town supervisor Dan Hoag Jr. said he's neutral. Why did he say that?
He's neutral as far as, like, if people want to use it and have it in their house, much like alcohol, he's okay with that. But he feels for his town, which is a small country store type of town, Forestburg is very, very small, he feels that type of business wouldn't fit within their town. But he sees it more for, like, bigger towns like Thompson and Bethel. And, you know, he's all for it. He's neutral on the subject. But he realized that other towns would have it. And to him personally, he feels it just wouldn't fit the type of community that Forestburg is.
When you started this reporting, were the town supervisors surprised to hear from you about this, or have they already been discussing it? Has it been a topic of conversation?
Some of them were, two of them were already in discussion. Actually, during my reporting, one of them was actually doing, one town was actually doing a vote, which you can see the what happened with that vote in my next article of these multi-part series. But a lot of them were sort of discussing it already. They haven't cut up to vote yet, but they were in discussion. And they know that they had this deadline to December 31st to opt out whether they want this type of business in their town or not.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Patricio Rubio. He is with Radio Catskill. He also reports for the Sullivan County Democrat. He has the first of a multi-part series on New York State's decision to legalize adult recreational marijuana use in the Sullivan County Democrat, and about towns' reactions, how they would vote if the resolution to have a cannabis business was put before them. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear more about Patricio's reporting in other towns in Sullivan County. This is Radio Chatskill.
On this week's On the Media, a look at how journalism selectively judges objectivity and bias.
Look, in my experience, no one has ever said, let's say, to a combat veteran, oh, you're too close to war, you can't be a war correspondent, or you can't cover veterans.
Standards for thee, others for me. On the next On the Media from WNYC.
Today at 4.
When things start to unravel.
A new release from Billy Bragg is always special, and on the next Waggaload of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on WJFF Radio Catskill, we'll hear the new single from Billy Bragg. Join me, please, for this little treat, Sunday afternoon at 3.
Support comes from the Catskills Food Hub, connecting the community with local and regionally sourced fresh food. Order online and pick up weekly in Liberty, Livingston Manor, Margaretville, Narrowsburg, and Wurtsboro. Supporting agriculture and contributing to a healthier community. CatskillsFoodHub.org. From the River Reporter newspaper, RiverReporter.com. And from listener donations at WJFFRadio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're talking to our own Patricio Rubio about his reporting in the Sullivan County Democrat about New York State's decision to legalize adult recreational marijuana use in the state. Marijuana use for medical reasons has been legal for a few years, but no medical dispensaries exist in Sullivan County. Some towns are saying they may not allow a commercial cannabis business to sell within their town once the state has those regulations in place. Patricio is here to tell us more about his reporting. And again, he spoke to several town supervisors, and the views expressed are of the town supervisors themselves and not the reflective of the entire board. Patricio, you mentioned you spoke to the town supervisor in Liberty, who said he was not in favor of legalizing another vice, as he put it.
Right. And he was concerned about having another thing in the market that people can use, like I said, as a vice. He talked about the problem we have in Sullivan County now with the opioid, and also he also mentioned having another vice like alcohol, and now to throwing another thing into the mix of marijuana. He feels it could cause a whole host of issues down the road. And his decision his take on it is that this is a state issue. And he doesn't feel why should a town have to burden themselves with necessary enforcement or resources to enforce this or to go through the whole process. So he feels if this is a state issue, let the state handle it. And that's where he is right now. But right now, it doesn't look like he's in a rush to sort of pass this local law. Some have already. One or two towns already have passed the local law, which I'll talk about in my next series. About that, they have passed the local law already to opt out.
And that's happened already in the town of Lumberland. And it's interesting what's actually happening in the town of Lumberland when it comes to marijuana use or marijuana growth. But in terms of opting out, they've already held a vote, right?
Right. They held a vote on July 14th to opt out of the commercial sale of marijuana and the on-site consumptions.
But the executive committee of the Sullivan County Legislature approved an agricultural zone for a farm in Lumberland last Thursday, expanding the farm's opportunities for industrialized hemp growth within the county. That's reporting from your colleague Lily Parnell at the Democrat.
Right, right. Yes. So this is where the two sides of the coins, like the town of Lumberland, I said they don't want the commercial sales of it on the outside consumption, but they do approve a farm that would have, that basically will grow it. So there's two sides of these coins. I said there is the size of sales and consumption and the size of the growers.
Yeah, there's an interesting portion of Lily's reporting about this, about some history about industrial hemp farming and production. And she reports that since 1937, hemp was incorrectly associated with marijuana and banned throughout the United States. And wealthy businessmen such as Andrew Mellon, William Randolph Hearst, and the DuPont family sparked prohibition. And that while hemp and marijuana are derived from the cannabis plant, hemp also provides no psychoactive effects when ingested. So there's a little bit of a difference of splitting the hairs there, I guess. But they are looking at bringing industrialized hemp to Sullivan County and stake a claim in that market, in the town of Lumberland, at least. In the town of Rockland, when it comes to the commercial dispensaries that we're talking about under the New York state law, what are they saying? Their town supervisor, Robert Eggleton, spoke to you.
So the big question is, are they going to receive a share of the revenues from the sales? And and he wants to use those revenues to further combat the sale, further combat the illegal use of drugs. And also he's also concerned about how things will be tested. He's also concerned that we're trying to, his quote is, we're trying to stop people from smoking, but now we want to promote it. Meaning promoting it with smoking with marijuana cigarettes. But of course, if marijuana is not only taken in cigarette form, there's edibles, there's oils, there's lotions, there's pills. There's a variety of different ways that people can consume marijuana that doesn't have to be the old way of just smoking it.
Yeah, cannabis, yes. Tobacco, no. Maybe there's some mixed messages going out there, I guess, according to some. And then in the town of Thompson, which is, I guess, what some of the smaller towns are saying, maybe these should be in larger towns like the town of Thompson. What are they what are they thinking there? Or what did at least the town supervisor say to you?
Right. Yeah, I spoke to Bill Reber. So he said he would not support opting out of the marijuana sales. So he feels it's a great opportunity for the region, and to have the sale of marijuana in Thompson will be a great revenue stream for them. And which is, Thompson's been doing fantastic these past couple of years with the casino. The revenue stream coming into Thompson is enormous, so much that they've lowered their taxes for the past 6 years because of the amount of money that's coming from the casino, barring this past year with the COVID. So Thompson having a dispensary in their town, it will be just more revenue coming into the town. And with more revenue coming to the town, meaning they could fix things in the town, fix roads, fix signs, fix lights.
Yeah, this is there's an article in the New York Times this last week saying it's an $8 billion question for these towns. I mean, at least this is a large potential generation of cash, $8.7 billion annually within 5 years potentially in the cannabis marketplace because of the size of the state. But these municipal leaders are wrestling with this question. Did you get the feeling that it's not only about impaired driving, but maybe perhaps even impact on the younger generation? Did you get some indication of that from your reporting?
That I didn't. That's something that was surprising. And maybe it could have been my fault that the way I phrased my question, it was just about this opting out law. But no one that I spoke to has spoken about the real reason why this law was passed. Like you talk about the New York Times article, they did a survey in 2018 that found that Hispanic people across New York City were arrested on low-level marijuana charges 5 times more than white people were. And for black people, it was even worse. It was 15 times more the rate than compared to white people. And in the neighborhoods where calls were placed with the police for coming for marijuana and things like that, people of color were arrested more compared to white people, according to this survey that the New York Times did. And so that was the real reason behind this law, was we have these people who are in jail for low-level crimes who can't afford bail. There is this injustice, according to some of these surveys and some of the numbers that we are seeing from the state and from places like New York Times, that people of color are being arrested more compared to people who are not. And so the officials want to hope that this new law will sort of help that injustice and end that disparity we're having right now.
Yeah. And then also, do you think that there's maybe there's a stigma attached to it a little bit still? I mean, I know we joked a little bit about Woodstock, but it doesn't. I guess that some people might have a stigma about use of marijuana. But as we said, it's been legal in medical use for a while. And then there are several states like Colorado who've, you know, been successful in converting this into a commercial business as well. I wonder if there's still kind of that sticky stigma.
Yeah, I believe so, because one of the town supervisors I spoke to, you know, he mentioned that how the marijuana is much stronger than it was back in the days of Woodstock, which is true. But he said, oh, you don't know what they're putting into it, which might be true if you're buying from someone on the street. But now that we have medical marijuana and we have growers and we have these factories and this whole system just putting this product together, it's refined. It's the scientists who are looking into this, and it's not something you buy from the street that you don't know who can get it for it. This is medically graded. This is refined. This is tested, and you know exactly what you're getting, and you know how strong it is. There's different, you know, levels of marijuana you can get, and so that's why a lot of people I think may not realize that how advanced this product has become.
And New York State even has an office of cannabis management. It's cannabis.ny.gov. Patricio, thanks for your reporting. You're going to continue this multi-part series. Which towns will you be speaking to next in the Democrat, and when will we see that in the paper?
I'm talking to the rest of the handful. I'm talking to the town of Fallsburg, other towns like that, and also talking to the villages, because I said every municipality has to have to pass this law. So the town of Thompson, where I'm trying to secure, make sure I have my information right, town Thompson could opt in, but the village of Monticello, which is within the town of Thompson, could opt out. So that is a scenario I'm looking into and investigating, and that will be my reporting within the week. It should be in the Sullivan County Democrat.
We've been talking to Patricio Rubio. You know him from Radio Catskill, and he's on Radio Catskill today. He's working with us, but he's also reporting for the Sullivan Democrat, a multi-part series about the legalization of commercial use of marijuana in New York State and how local towns in Sullivan County are reacting or might react to those businesses in their town on their main street. Patricio, thanks for joining us this morning, and we'll look for your next article.
Thank you so much.
This is Radio Catskill. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Leif Johansson and his podcast, Close to Home, going deep into the administrative divisions of towns, cities, and villages.
WJFF is your community radio station in whatever community you happen to be, thanks to the WJFF mobile app. Available for your Apple or Android device, the WJFF app lets you hear your favorite Catskill station anywhere in the world, from Monticello to Monte Carlo, from Honesdale to Honolulu, or just from your doorstep to downtown. Get the WJFF app from Google Play or the Apple App Store.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're all about the iconic Claudia Roden, who helped introduce the food of the Middle East to the English-speaking world. We talk with Claudia herself, and we talk with one of her biggest fans, Yotam Ottolenghi. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
Sunday at noon on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Earlier, we spoke about how towns and villages in Sullivan County might react to allowing commercial cannabis businesses in their main streets. But how are these cities and towns and villages all set up? Luckily, we have a 20-something armchair policy wonk who was born and raised in the Catskills. He has a lot of questions, and he poses them on his WJFF Radio Catskill podcast, Close to Home. It's Leif Johansson, and he's taking a solo trip through this bizarre world of administrative divisions in his recent episode. Here's an excerpt.
Mm-hmm. We're taking a break this week from our rural transportation infrastructure series to do a quick romp through a truly riveting topic, the administrative divisions of New York State. Okay, kidding. That makes paint drying sound like a thrill ride. But as boring as they sound, these administrative divisions are actually pretty weird. Growing up in the Catskills, I knew that we had towns and villages and hamlets, but it was never clear to me what that meant or why we seemed to have different classifications for places that just didn't seem all that different from one another. So I thought it might be worth doing a short episode on what these different municipal administrative divisions are and how they came to be. First, let's zoom out a little bit. The fundamental idea behind these divisions is that there is a classification hierarchy for places in the United States. Obviously, the United States is at the top, and below that we have 50 states, 5 territories, and a federally administered District of Columbia. Although DC is pushing hard to change its classification to a state, which is a fascinating topic in and of itself that is totally worth reading up on if you have a few minutes. When we get to our administrative divisions below the level of states and territories, that's when stuff starts to get a little odd. Because when the United States was founded, one of its core principles was states' rights, as a way of decentralizing our government enough that a dictatorial monarchy was, for all intents and purposes, impossible. And in practice, that meant that states had a lot of autonomy in deciding how they would organize themselves. For example, when we look at just one order of classification below the level of states, we have counties, right? Everyone in the United States lives in a county. But even that's not true. Already, the standardization begins to unravel just 2 levels down from the country as a whole. The state of Louisiana doesn't have counties. It has parishes. And the state of Alaska has boroughs instead of counties, which is completely different from the boroughs that we would find in New York City or New Jersey. And half of Alaska falls within what they call unorganized boroughs, which actually aren't boroughs at all. They're just extra land that we don't really know what to do with. There is also something called an independent city, which is a city not within a county at all, because it was historically chartered as its own autonomous region, operating only under the umbrella of a state instead of a county governmental structure. And there are 41 of these countyless cities in the United States, including Baltimore, Maryland, Carson City, Nevada, and St. Louis, Missouri. And the other 38 are just all the cities in the state of Virginia, because Virginia state law dictates that any area incorporated as a city within that state is outside the jurisdiction of a county. Below the level of counties, we have towns, sort of, usually. There are tons of exceptions to this as well. In many southern states, for example, there are no towns, and instead, counties are the smallest unit of government. In California, towns and cities are the same thing. In New Jersey, there are both towns and townships, and of course, a township is a completely different municipal classification than a town. In Pennsylvania, there are boroughs instead of towns, which are also different from the administrative classification of Alaska's boroughs and New York City's boroughs. And below towns, any semblance of standardization across different states pretty much disappears. Most states have villages, but the definition of a village and its municipal structure and governance is completely different from state to state. In some states, villages must have less than 5,000 people. In others, they must have less than 500 people. In New York, they must have more than 500 people. And in some states, a, quote, village classification is illegal altogether. All of that said, let's take a look at New York State. Things here are actually fairly straightforward. We have 62 counties, and every place in the state exists within a county, including New York City, whose population of 8.4 million people sprawls between five different counties: Kings, Queens, Richmond, Bronx, and New York. So people living in Manhattan live in New York City, in New York County, in New York State. Just to stick it to those slimy New Jerseyans living across the river. Below the county division in New York, we have cities and towns, which sort of operate on the same level. As per our own state laws, cities cannot exist within towns. So in New York, you either live in a city or a town. Right now, about 54% of New Yorkers live in a city, and 42% of New Yorkers live specifically in New York City. But New York City is actually only one of 62 cities in New York State. And yes, we have 62 cities and 62 counties, and it would be so satisfying if we had one city per county, but of course, that's not how it works. So that means that 13% of New York residents are divided up between the other 61 cities. So doesn't that mean that some of those cities must be pretty small? Well, yes, because there is actually no population or land area requirement to be a city in New York State. New York's smallest city by population is the city of Sherrill, which has less than 3,100 residents. And the state's smallest city by area is the city of Mechanicville, with a land area of only 0.83 square miles and a population of about 5,200 people. The other 46% of New Yorkers live in towns rather than cities, and New York State is divided into 932 towns. Towns in New York State often provide a pared-down, localized version of county services, such as local road maintenance, sewage treatment, town courts, tax collection, and local planning and zoning boards. The largest town in New York by population is Hempstead, over on Long Island, with a population of 760,000 people. And the town with the fewest people is Red House, over in western New York, with only 38 permanent residents. Sullivan County is divided into 15 different towns, and lacking any cities in our county, you cannot exist in any location in Sullivan County without being in a town. However, that was almost not the case. I recently got in touch with Sullivan County historian John Conway, who we previously heard from on Close to Home in our episodes about Catskill's dairy farms. And John told me that Sullivan County did actually have a city at one point. It was called the City of Douglas, and it was chartered in 1867, only to be abandoned 5 years later. It was meant to rival Binghamton in its size and industrial strength, and it was located near where Long Eddy is today, on the northwest side of the county along the Delaware River. The plan was to dam the river and use its energy to power an entire city's worth of industry. Except, the dam project never really got off the ground, in part because of the impact it would have had on the then-booming timber rafting industry by lowering the water level downstream from the dam and making it harder to float rafts down the river. But without that power from the river, any significant industrial development was impossible in the mid-19th century. So it wasn't long until folks gave up, and Sullivan County's token city disappeared.
That's Leif Johansson from Radio Catskills Close to Home podcast, Leif's podcast. He loves this stuff. You can hear the rest of Leif's Close to Home podcast at wjffradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll take a short break. When we come back, Mark Randall and the amazing world of the honeybee. This is Radio Catskill.
If you hear good music, you're listening to Radio Catskill. Your weekend can't even begin until Clyde Alvin Yates III sets it off Saturday night at 7. At 9, an hour of global sounds from the African diaspora on Afropop.
Then at 10, Selector Starkey and DJ Chuck spend 4 hours of funk, hip-hop, roots reggae, club classics, and more live on Old School Sessions. Saturday nights only on Radio Catskill.
This group is dangerous.
On Catskill Character this week, my guest is Dwayne Cunningham of Orson, Pennsylvania. This guy is a real clown, and he didn't have to run away to the circus to become a genuine Ringling Brothers clown. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Please join me and my guest Dwayne Cunningham this Saturday at 11:30 on Radio Catskill. There'll be lots of clowning around.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Later today at 3 this afternoon at the Narrowsburg Union, Mark Randall, proprietor of Beeline Ice Cream and an assistant professor of design and strategies at Parsons School of Design, will have an introduction to the honeybee and its impact on human culture. It's a talk called The Amazing World of Honeybees. I spoke to him about it and how he got his start in honeybees and honey.
I always wanted to do some kind of agricultural activity, and my uncle introduced me to beekeeping, and I thought, well, I'm not a gardener, but I could be a beekeeper. So I've been keeping bees up here for about 20 years, and, you know, over that time, produced a lot of honey. I've also really liked making ice cream, and when I was a kid, my father was really into making ice cream, so I always kind of associated making ice cream with kind of communal family events, and so up here, I had all this honey. I would spend every summer, we would have what we would call an ice cream social, where I'd make all this ice cream and we would serve it. And some of it was honey ice cream. And people gave me great feedback on the honey ice cream. Years ago, when they launched the Honeybee Fest, I thought, let me make some honey ice cream. So I partnered with Amy at Early Bird Cookery, and we made honey ice cream, and it was a big hit at the Honeybee Festival. So that's what kind of got me going on this idea of making honey ice cream. And about 3 years ago, in 2019, I launched a pop-up shop at the Narrowsburg Union in the summer where I make and sell honey ice cream.
And you have a conversation coming up, The Amazing World of the Honeybee. I want to ask you about that. But before I ask you about that, I want to ask you just in general, why do you think people are still afraid of bees?
I don't know that people are afraid of bees. I mean, I think some people are. But my experience is that people are endlessly fascinated by bees. So I can give you a story. So I teach at Parsons School of Design. And whenever I would mention to my students that I was a beekeeper, it was like the room would stop. And all they would do was give me a litany of questions about bees. They were endlessly fascinated about it. And so I thought, oh, there's an idea for a class here. And so I actually have a class at Parsons School of Design on bees. And I've had students take the class to get over their fear of bees. So there are some people afraid of bees, but I actually find that people are kind of endlessly fascinated by them.
What do you teach in the class? What's the class about?
Well, the class is really about how bees are a metaphor for life. It's really about the intersection of art, design, science, and culture all through the lens of bees and beekeeping, which is a little bit about what I'm going to touch on in my talk. But, you know, humans have grown up alongside bees ever since Homo sapiens emerged, because bees have been on the earth for millions of years. So we've always had kind of a connection and interacted with bees. And we've interacted not only for, the honey and the beeswax that bees produce, but they've become kind of metaphors for how we view the world, you know, across all cultures.
And we see them on flowers. We know about the honey. What other important roles do bees play in our daily lives and in our ecology?
Well, I mean, bees are great pollinators. So, you know, for example, if there were no honeybees, there would be no almonds. Almonds are 100% pollinated by honeybees. So they, you know, I think they contribute like $20 billion to U.S. crop production each year. I mean, it's a really important part of our ecosystem. I think a couple of years ago, an organization in London, the Earthwatch Institute, sort of considered bees one of the most important creatures on the planet because of their because of their pollination skills. I mean, if we didn't have bees, I mean, so much of our food is pollinated by bees that it's really important that we make every effort to kind of create a sustainable environment for them to thrive in, which we're currently not doing.
Does that mean that the bees are in danger, or is it still possible that bees could become extinct?
But yeah, there's been some discussion about that. I mean, you know, it's been really challenging. I think something like beekeepers across the United States, I think, lost like 45% of their hives over the winter. And it's just all the stresses that our current society is putting on bees. You know, there's monoculture, there's pesticides, there's all kinds of disease, mites and fungus that sort of attack the bees. And it's just really all because of the way the earth is becoming sort of imbalanced is really reflected in bees. I almost think of bees in some ways as like the canary in the coal mine.
And in your talk, The Amazing World of the Honeybee, you're pairing up with Officer Darren Mays. He has an interesting title. Can you tell folks about Officer Mays' role in
I'm so excited that he's coming. So Officer Mays works for the New York City Police Department. He's a policeman. And ironically, if you live in New York City and there's a swarm of bees that like land on your car, or the most famous recent one was like on a hot dog stand in Times Square, you call 311, you call the city and say, oh my God, there's a swarm of bees. And so they actually pass the call on to the New York City Police Department, who has on staff Darren Mays, who's a police officer, who then goes out and captures the swarm.
Really?
And, you know, he does it in a, yeah, it's a job. So he, you know, gets suited up. He's got like this vacuum cleaner that sucks up the bees, but in a way that doesn't harm them. And then he'll either keep them or he'll give them to somebody. So, you know, he finds them a really good home. So that's part of what his job is as a policeman.
How did you come to know Officer Mays? There wasn't a swarm of bees attacking you, I assume.
No, actually, he's quite, you know, in the beekeeping world, especially in New York City, he's quite well known. And he's been on the news and you know, interviewed in newspapers and things. And so I always knew about him. So that was one of the great things about teaching this class at Parsons School of Design, is that it allowed me to reach out to people and connect with them. And so I took my students to the roof of the precinct that he works out of in Queens to check out his honeybees. And that's how we met.
And you're going to, or he's going to share some of his adventure stories of capturing some of these bee swarms in the talk?
Yes. All over New York City. Yeah, in trees, on hot dog stand carts, in cars, on light poles, all over the city.
Only in New York, kids.
Yes, exactly.
And what else will you be introducing folks to in your Amazing World of the Honeybee conversation?
Well, we'll talk a little bit about just bees and, you know, how they work. It's an introduction to bees, kind of the history of beekeeping, a very brief overview of the history of beekeeping, and then how, you know, beekeeping has impacted art, design, science, and culture. We have a lot of, it's all going to be very informal and conversational, and we're hoping to leave room for lots of questions.
And do you have your own adventure story with bees?
I suppose I do. I mean,
can you tell
I
us?
Always think beekeeping is a kind of an ongoing adventure, but probably not as dramatic as Darren's. Darren will have much more dramatic stories, you know, climbing all over New York City trying to capture bees. I've done it in a couple of trees on my property, which was much easier than like trying to climb a building.
We've been talking to Mark Randall, proprietor of Beeline Ice Cream and an assistant professor of design strategies at Parsons School of Design. And he and Officer Darren Mays, New York City's bee cop, will be talking about the amazing world of the honeybee. It is at 3 o'clock at the Narrowsburg Union, the Upper Delaware Welcome Center at the Narrowsburg Union on Erie Avenue in Narrowsburg, New York. More information at narrowsburgunion.com. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, and hope to see everybody.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Pooches on Parade at Riverfest. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm your host, Kusar Grace KG, right here in the place to be. The Music Emporium, Tuesday, 7 to 9 on 90.5 FM. Community-supported radio serving the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, and the Upper Delaware Valley. all those other towns, villages, and hamlets who pick up our broadcast, big shout out to you.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Where can you discover regional handmade crafts, live local music, and hands-on ecological activities? Well, it's at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance 31st Annual Riverfest, tomorrow along Narrowsburg's Main Street. The day kicks off at 10 a.m. with a very popular event. It's the River Dogs on Parade. Here to tell us more about it is the Master of Ceremonies for the parade, Kevin McDonough. Kevin, how are you?
I'm good. I'm just waiting. We're less than 24 hours away from the dog parade.
Are you excited? Excited?
Oh, always. You know, particularly this year, since last year was interrupted. It'll be great. It's great to see everyone. It's a thoroughly silly start to the festivities. People come. When it began, almost 20 years ago, it was about costumes. And a lot of people still dress up their dogs, but some people just come, as they are. And, they come up, and I talk to them about their dogs, and, we just exchange pleasantries in a kind of art link letter kind of, dogs say the darndest thing sort of fashion. And it's all pretty silly. There's little prizes and treats, and it's often, 40, 50 people watching. It's amazing.
Well, I was going to say silly, but popular. A lot of people come and watch, but they also come and bring their dogs. You've had advanced registration. Do you have a big lineup already?
I don't. I just show up in kibitz. I'm not on the...
You work with what you have.
Excuse me?
You work with what you have. You show up,
exactly.
And if they're there...
Some years we've had dozens, and other years, because of weather and heat. Looks like it's going to be a glorious day tomorrow. I hope we get a good turnout. One year a cat won. It was very controversial.
How did that happen?
That's the judges. I'm just the MC. I don't talk. I don't get into the weeds there. They made that decision. Some people were delighted, others were outraged. A couple years ago, family brought a duck, so it's been fun.
You stay out of the politics. It seems like it could be controversial, but you did mention those judges. We happen to know a few of those here at Radio Catskill.
Yeah, well, you got Greg and
Greg
Dean
Trix
and Donna
Fellenberg, host of Catskill, yes. Character, which is coming up at 11:30.
Yes,
and then is there another judge on the panel as well?
I think those are the three that Jeffrey assigned.
Okay.
But anything can happen at the dog parade.
tell us more tales of the dog parade in your years of doing it. How long have you done it, and what was one of your favorite memories?
I guess I've done it since about 2006, I think, maybe 2005. I don't know. I know I entered my own dogs in 2004 as just a mere civilian. And sometime after that, I've been emceeing. It's just, people came... People used to come from far and wide years ago. There was a young high school girl, about 3 years running. She was spectacular. She would dress up as the groom, and the dog would be the bride. She'd be a patient. The dog would be a doctor. It was fantastic. Some real, real imagination has gone into a lot of into the costumes. And other are just dogs who do little treats and such. It's hard to pick your favorites,
Yeah. So when folks gather, how does it work? Are you parading down the street and interviewing folks, and then is there a ceremony?
Is everyone goes to the feed mill and they get a number, they register. I think $10 goes to the DVAA, and then they literally walk half a block to the post office, and at that point, on top of some green AstroTurf, I believe. And at that point, I interview them, and the judges look at and see what they're doing and how they're dressed and how they behave, and we used to have set categories, but the judges now kind of improvise. The prizes sort of fit the talent we have.
Do you know what some of the prizes are this year? You mentioned treats and things like that.
Yeah, the little treats. Everyone's going to get little ribbons and treats.
And folks can register day of. You can registration starts at 9. So if you want to enter, you're hearing this now. And as you've heard, it's open to all, not just dog identifying.
Yes, dog identifying. And costumes are fun, but, you know, if you don't have the time or the inclination, some people see them as, you know, humiliating to the dogs.
Yeah.
And I have three pugs, and I think they look fine as they are, you know.
Are you entering them this year?
It depends on how hot it is and how, what my, sort of the logistics of trying to MC and deal with three dogs at the same time can be difficult.
And as we said, it's not Westminster, so come in and just have some fun and be silly and kick off
the
day.
That's what it's about, to come and be silly. And it's a great kickoff to the overall thing, because it sort of sets a tone that everyone's welcome. You know, some people aren't necessarily arts, you know, interested in culture and arts and such, but everyone's welcome. It's a great street fair, too, you know, it's a great annual event at the height of summer, DVAA, and it's been going on for, though, that's 31 years now, and it's just it's a great tradition. And the dog parade is just a silly footnote to it, but I'm, you know, very happy that we do it every year.
Well, it's fun that it kicks off, and I'm just going to run down some of the agenda for tomorrow for folks who want to know, who may not have been or who missed last year and want to know what the schedule is.
Yeah, and I really want to welcome people who, you know, so many people have come up here since COVID and everything.
Yeah, you have to come and see it. It's a great community experience, and Radio Catskill is a proud media sponsor of the event. And the day kicks off, as we've been saying, at 10 with River Dogs on Parade. Kevin is MC. And then vendors lining up and down Main Street overlooking the Delaware River until 4, open from 10 to 4. At 11, it's Eco Hip Hop with Nate and Hilla. Also, the Kids Craft Corner is at 11 with Manon Manavit. At 12:30, Farm Arts Collective Street Theater Performance, which is always fun. Look for folks on stilts. At 1, it's the Riverfest Poster Auction with auctioneer Jeff Spitz. That's always a big draw. And at 2 to 4, there's a live music with Slam Allen, the band, and friends. So a great day.
I just want to plug another thing. I'll be there off and on. The Western Sullivan Public Library is going to have a booth, and we're just going to be letting people know about the, you know, what you can, what the library offers, and if you are new to the area or if you've never gotten a library card, it's a good place to sign up, and it's a great resource for people. And again, for people who are new to the area, it's a resource some people may not know about.
Oh, yeah, lots of great stuff at the library. And Radio Catskill will be there. I'll be there with some of our volunteers, and we'll be out on the street saying hi and giving out some bumper stickers and magnets, and we have some tote bags, too. So come by and see us, see the WSPL folks with Kevin, and stay around all day. Come at 10 to see those dogs on parade. We've been talking to Kevin McDonough. He is the MC of the River Dogs on Parade at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance Riverfest, starting tomorrow at 10 with that parade, and more information about the whole day at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. I'll let you go prep for your MC duties, Kevin.
Yes, I've got I'm gargling and, you know.
You got the voice exercises.
I'm getting my lint brush out and, you know, get the dog fur off. But I hope to see you there.
I'll see you there, and we hope to see everybody there. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, be well.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to see you at Riverfest tomorrow. We'll be there at our booth, the Radio Catskill booth. Come say hi. Thanks for listening.
This week in This American Life. Maybe you've seen some of the hype for Shot Girl Summer. You know, post-pandemic singles hooking up like crazy, leaving clothes behind in the bathrooms of singles bars.
Our Lost and Found is currently filled with pants. I don't know. I've never seen this happen. I've got skirts. I've got shorts.
Wait, is this true?
This is true.
But America, we're here to report it is not all as it seems. As this week.
Saturday at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Women's Health Center in Honesdale, Hamlin, Waymart, Carbondale, and Lords Valley in Pennsylvania. Physicians and certified midwives who deliver. The Women's Health Center is a Wayne Memorial Community Health Center. WMH.org. From Rourke Law, Liberty, New York, a general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley. with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. Damascus Citizens